Okay. Well, as we enter a new Cold War with the US and its allies on the one side and China on the other, I think it's worth looking at the history and politics of the last Cold War. And that's not because there's a template that's going to repeat or anything like that. But as I'm going to go on to argue, the perspective of neither Washington nor Moscow but international socialism is the only approach that kept leftists on the side of class struggle and genuine socialism during the last Cold War. And we're going to need its hostility to both sides in inter-imperialist rivalry as a guide to the Cold War that's taking off at the moment. So the Cold War imperialist rivalry between the United States and the USSR shaped world politics through half a century, and it was a product of the imperialist carve-up of the world after World War II. Even the final event of the war, the US's barbarous use of the atom bomb against Japan in 1945, was at least partly motivated by a desire to show Stalin what he was going to be up against in the new division of the world after World War II. And you can see why the US wanted to send this signal. After World War II, Stalinism massively expanded, and expanded on the basis of military conquest, but also on the basis of agreements with the ruling classes of the West. And that element is generally missed out of histories of the Cold War. For example, there was a meeting in Moscow between Churchill and Stalin in October 1944. Churchill had kind of worked out that the British Empire was fading, but he wanted to get in on the carve-up afterwards. And Churchill made a proposal on a scrap of paper to divide post-war Europe into Western and Soviet spheres of influence. That phrase, spheres of influence, always worry when you hear that. And so Churchill wrote down the percentages for each country, who would get how much of each place. Stalin examined the scrap of paper, pondered it for a minute, put a big tick in blue pencil on it and handed it back to Churchill. Churchill then commented, "Might it not be thought rather cynical if it seemed we had disposed of such issues so fateful to millions of people in such an offhand manner? Let us burn the paper." "Nah, you keep it," said Stalin. I think this is a nice summary of how the Cold War kind of, you know, really what underlay it. But as I said, whatever Churchill thought, the victors on the winning side of World War II were not the fading British Empire, but the USSR and the United States. Now, due to technical difficulties, I can't show you all my lovely slides, but imagine here a picture of three well-fed, well-dressed, self-satisfied guys at the 1945 Yalta Conference. It took place in February. US President Franklin D. Roosevelt was present, and it proceeded in a similarly cavalier manner to the discussion that Churchill and Stalin had had a few months earlier. To the victor go the spoils, as they say, and they were going to win the imperialist conflict of World War II. They knew that by this point, and the shape of the post-war world was therefore theirs to determine. On the basis of this, after the war, most of Eastern Europe was taken over by the armies of the USSR and incorporated into its sphere of influence in the post-war carve-up. Russian armies installed loyal governments in these countries, not to spread socialism, but as a barrier to the West and a source of plunder for the Russian state. Where there was resistance and even revolutionary upheavals following the defeat of the Nazis in World War II, the role of the Communist parties and or the Russian troops in Eastern Europe was to derail them. And so a famous example, and one that, you know, really sticks in your throat, really, was in Poland. Stalin allowed the Nazis to crush the 1944 Warsaw uprising before Russian troops that were waiting on the outskirts of Warsaw actually went in to intervene. And as Stalin's foreign minister, and you know, no better than to get it from the horse's mouth, Stalin's foreign minister Litvinov told US representatives meeting in Italy, which they were also interested in dividing up, who was going to get that. This is in September 1944. Litvinov said, pretty blunt, "We do not want revolutions in the West." Now, initially in Eastern Europe, Stalin instructed the communist parties to enter coalition governments with a range of pro-capitalist parties, some of them quite right-wing, sometimes local social democrats, whatever. Regardless of politics, in every country, Russia ensured that the Communist Party got control of three ministries. And what were they? The police, the military and internal security. With Russian control of Eastern Europe, the communist parties, many of which had been quite minor parties, grew rapidly. People could see which side their bread was going to be buttered on, and only in Yugoslavia were the communist parties independent from, were the Communist Party independent from Moscow. Post-war imperialist rivalry with the United States accelerated Russian domination from 1947 as the Cold War began in earnest. And if there was a moment when the Cold War was declared, it was probably Churchill's speech. He was in opposition now. He wasn't running Britain. That he made in Fulton, Missouri in March 1946. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended on the continent of Europe. He didn't make any mention of his own role in mapping the contours of that iron curtain. Again, here, imagine, if you will, a map of Europe and the divide being made in the way that curtain's out, Churchill's outlined. What was the US doing? Well, they were economically the dominant power in the world, and they wanted an anti-communist bloc in Western Europe. And so they used their strength, that is their economic strength, they poured aid in, the Dawes Plan and, more importantly, the Marshall Plan, to revive the economies of Europe under US hegemony. And that didn't mean just economic domination, it meant political domination. Within weeks, the communists were forced out of the governments of France and Italy. This was how the world was going to be. It wasn't just that you lined up economically, you got aid from somewhere, but you lined up politically, ideologically, and so on. And Stalin was taking similar measures in Eastern Europe. In 1947 to 1948, the Eastern European governments that the communists had entered were transformed from the top down into more or less close replicas of Stalin's Russia. They were purged of their non-communist elements and became the grossly misnamed people's democracies, nothing to do with people and nothing to do with democracy. And the people's democracies were essentially run by the most slavishly loyal elements of the communist parties. There was nothing socialist about them. The secret police destroyed resistance. And by resistance, they didn't just mean people that wanted to upend the whole system, or they didn't just mean pro-Western supporters. They meant by resistance Communist Party leaders who showed any degree of independence from Stalin. They all had to be got rid of as well, executed in many cases. And that was especially the case after Tito, the leader of Yugoslavia, broke with Stalin in 1948 to pursue a policy of non-alignment. Instead, Russia operated in the Eastern Bloc in classically imperialist fashion, initially with so-called reparations, more honestly we could call them looting, where gold reserves, equipment, and even entire factories were sent back to Russia, and then with other exploitative arrangements that will be familiar to all of us from other imperialist powers, the annexation of territory, which is what happened in Poland, or exploitative trade relationships where the Russians got raw materials cheap and the people's democracies, so-called, were required to buy Russian goods at inflated prices. And the agreements between the Western powers and Russia as to how the post-war world was going to be divided up did not stop at the Iron Curtain that divided continental Europe. So, for example, the division in 1945 of Korea, along that most obvious and logical of divides, a line drawn on the map by US General Douglas MacArthur. And each superpower, once they got their half of Korea, installed their own dictator, Kim Il-sung in the north and Syngman Rhee in the south. In the West, the Cold War, with its rhetoric of freedom, you see why I hate all those bloody Gladys Berejiklian uses of freedom. It's got such a shit history, this word, which is tragic. But the rhetoric of freedom was very strong in the Western Cold War narrative. And that freedom meant campaigns against communists and left-wing activists. In the US, for example, the Taft-Hartley Act, a law which required unions to purge communist officials from their unions. And it was a time of rigid ideological conformity, not just in the East, but in the West as well, embodied, I think, in the US, particularly in Senator Joe McCarthy's House Un-American Activities Committee, it witch-hunted government employees, figures from the entertainment industry, though witch-hunted from jobs and from influence. And most of Western liberalism capitulated to or even led the Cold War anti-communist hysteria, leading to a massive shift to the right in the workers' movement and the undermining of struggles in general, because struggle was so easily demonised as being, in inverted commas, communist, that is, on the wrong side of the Cold War. Instead, liberals everywhere aligned with their own ruling class's anti-communist worldview. Now, I want to say a little bit now about military rivalry, because while the two blocs were largely cut off from each other economically, they set up rival military alliances, NATO for the West, the Warsaw Pact for the East. And it was this military competition that structured both their economies throughout the Cold War. From early on, there were unprecedented levels of peacetime military expenditure, never been seen before. In the United States, about 20% of the US's national output went to military expenditure, and about 40% of Russia's, because Russia's economy was commensurately quite a lot smaller. And this was the beginning of an arms race, which was very rapidly nuclear on both sides. Stalin had learnt the lesson of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and moved to get nukes as soon as he could. And the arms race continued throughout the Cold War, a race that both sides had facilities to destroy the world many times over. So how did the left respond to this? I've said already that Western liberalism largely became advocates of the freedom narrative of the US. The Western Communist parties obviously welcomed all this as the triumph of socialism. And they used to talk about the socialist third of the world. And a third of the world had gone socialist, particularly once China in 1949 and regimes essentially similar to that of the USSR were established by military means, by peasant armies led by intellectuals in the case of China. But this was not the only, although it was certainly the dominant, voice on the anti-capitalist left. Instead of this rosy picture, though, British Marxist Chris Harman gives a more realistic one, and I'll read in some detail what he has to say. As ideological conformity was imposed on either side of the Iron Curtain, a generation grew up under the shadow of the bomb. Anyone in either camp who dared to oppose this monstrosity could expect to be labelled a supporter or even an agent of the other. All too often, this labelling was accepted by those in opposition. Many socialists in the West and Third World were misled into believing that the rulers of the USSR were on their side, while many dissidents in the Eastern Bloc believed Western leaders who claimed to stand for freedom and democracy. Those who stood out against this nonsense at the beginning of the 1950s were tiny in number. And so for the anti-capitalist left, the dominant current, as I said, was Stalinism, an outlook which opposed imperialism and militarism in the West in general, but often championed the imperialism of the USSR and often failed to support uprisings in the Eastern Bloc. On the other hand, there was ideological confusion in the ranks of the much smaller number of Trotskyists around the world. The orthodoxy that they had inherited from Trotsky himself, that Russia remained a worker state, although a degenerated one under Stalin, came under impossible strain after World War II. Why? Because the Russian military had set up regimes in Eastern Europe that were very quickly identical to the regime that existed in Russia. And so it posed the question, either they were all worker states, because Russia was supposedly a worker state, or they were all capitalist and Russia wasn't a worker state at all. The conclusion that the majority of the Fourth International, the major Trotskyist organisation, came to was that the Eastern Bloc must also be worker states, but ones that were deformed from birth rather than degenerated like Russia. And the justification for saying that they were worker states was that industry was in state hands. Now, a little diversion here, because I think we need to deal with this question that the fact that the state runs industry, that property is nationalised, is somehow a criterion for socialism. Because in my view, and certainly the view of Socialist Alternative who are putting on the conference, it's workers' power, not nationalised property. That's the hallmark of a worker state. The conclusion otherwise is that worker states could be brought into existence by Russian tanks. And the Marxists, the very influential Marxist in our tendency, Tony Cliff, drew the opposite conclusion. He said, well, clearly these states in Eastern Europe, there's been no working class revolution, therefore they cannot be worker states, but they're identical to Russia, therefore they must all be state capitalism. Because socialism is the act of the working class itself. A workers' revolution made by the working class themselves that destroys the capitalist state is the only way to socialism. And working class self-emancipation, the kind of thing that happened in Russia in 1917, is not an optional extra for Marxists. Now, why this mattered became clear with the Korean War that began in 1950 and went for 3 years. The Cold War became hot, not on an international scale, but certainly on the territory of Korea. With Stalin's backing, Kim Il-sung launched an attack on the South. He expected that the Southern regime was going to collapse and the US wouldn't intervene. He was wrong on both counts. Truman, the President of the United States, saw value in entering the war, both to get approval for a massive increase in military spending from Congress and because he was worried about what effect a victory for the Soviet bloc would have elsewhere. If they won in Korea, the dominoes might start falling. This domino analogy was one that the Western imperialists really loved during the Cold War. The war went on, as I said, for 3 years. It went on at massive human cost. At some point, half the population of the South lost their homes. Half of them became refugees in their own country for a period at least. It was enormously destructive. And what happened at the end of those 3 years? The new border was in the same place where General MacArthur had put it at the end of World War II. Was either side in this conflict anything to do with the project of human liberation? Tony Cliff, during this period, embraced the slogan which I mentioned at the beginning, neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism. In other words, the Cold War was a struggle between rival imperialist powers, not between capitalism and socialism. Okay. At this point, I would have showed you an image of a lovely badge that we made in the early 1980s with this slogan on it, but also with two lots of missiles pointing towards each other, one side US, the other side CCCP. And that argument of the mutually assured destruction, MAD as we used to call it, of the inter-imperialist rivalry was very strongly felt in the early 80s, as I'll come back to. So understanding the Cold War as an inter-imperialist rivalry between two competing capitalist blocs, and that the Russian side was in no sense progressive, let alone socialist, also enabled Tony Cliff's supporters to be on the right side of the political crises that blew up in opposition to Stalinism in the Eastern Bloc very soon after the Russian takeover. Whether it was from East Berlin in 1953 to the workers' uprisings in Hungary in 1956, again in the Prague Spring in 1968, again another invasion by the Russians to put it down as they had in Hungary in 1956, on the rise in Poland from in 1970 and 1976, and the rise of Solidarność in 1980, all of these, and I wish I had time to talk more about how marvellous these uprisings were and how clearly working class, in many cases, their whole orientation, their whole revolutionary nature was. So it was important to be able to know which side you were on when such working class revolutionary upheavals took off. During the Cold War, instead, both Stalinism and what Stalin and the West, those both sides of the Cold War, put forward a view of the world divided into two opposing camps, and they each had their language of it. What Stalinism called socialism versus imperialism, and in the West lying ruling class parlance, dictatorship versus freedom. And we'll see the same thing again in the coming Cold War, or the existing Cold War, really, between the US and Australia and others on one side and China on the other, the weaponizing of democracy, freedom, human rights, and so on. There's nothing new in that. And it's worth mentioning as well, of course, that both sides, when they talked about socialism, they talked about freedom, both sides were lying. And I think 1956 demonstrated the symmetry between the two blocs. As Britain, France, and Israel invaded Egypt to take over the Suez Canal, while Russia invaded Hungary to put down a workers' uprising. A polite silence was maintained on both sides. And a new left in the West was born out of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, but it was on a very small scale. That is, some who'd been communists and members of the Communist Party broke from Stalinism. But the widespread position of the international left in 1956 was still one of critical support for Stalinism, even if, as things moved on, occasional excesses became too much to stomach. In addition, if it was now accepted that a workers' state could be created by means other than working class revolution, this led to the adoption in varying degrees of political ideas which looked to some agency other than the working class for the achievement of socialism. And again, you could see this very clearly with the Chinese Revolution of 1949. A national liberation struggle, given what Lenin, when he was discussing national liberations, described as communist coloration. A national liberation struggle that was not a workers' revolution. Actually, the Chinese Communist Party took power in 1949 without a skerrick of working class content. And there were others who could see something to their advantage in the so-called socialist third of the world. For many leaders of newly independent states in the third world, there was a further reason to look to the USSR as a model. You think about it, after suffering economic stagnation or even regression under colonial rule, to the leaders of the newly independent former colonial states, the Russian economy seemed to have shown that it could be a model. It could grow faster than any other. It appeared to avoid the periodic depressions that plagued capitalism in the West, as it had in the 1930s. And so Russia and the Stalinist model became an inspiration for the way to develop the new nations that they were now leading. I have to say that these hopes turned out to be misplaced. Okay, a couple of other things. The Russian question, which I've spent a lot of time on, is what we call, everyone on the left called it the Russian question at the time, but the Russian question was not the only confronting issue that the left had to deal with during the Cold War. The nature of capitalism itself came under scrutiny. A brief upsurge in working class militancy in the West in the immediate aftermath of the war was followed not just by the Cold War, it was also followed by stabilisation and expansion of world capitalism on a scale and duration never seen before. And when social democrats and others to their right said, and I'm quoting here a right-wing social democrat from Britain, Anthony Crosland, who wrote this in 1956, he said, poverty and insecurity are in the process of disappearing. This is 1956. The war's been over for 8 years, what, no, 9 years, whatever. He said, poverty and insecurity are in the process of disappearing. Living standards are rising rapidly. The fear of unemployment is steadily weakening, and the ordinary young worker has hopes that would never have entered his father's head. And he was not lying. He was describing reality that lasted in the West until the early 1970s. Well, how were socialists to respond to this? The path of least resistance was reformism. The system can be fixed after all. Just look at the, there's not been a depression, things are going wonderfully, the economy's growing, working class living standards are rising and so on. All those things that Crossland had said were actually happening to vast amounts of the working class in the imperialist West. For those who wanted to maintain an anti-capitalist stance, however, where could they go? If you didn't want to just capitulate and say, oh, well, capitalism's pretty good after all, sorry I ever opposed it, then where could you go? Well, there was denial. With the return of the Great Depression just around the corner, year in and year out. Well, that one really couldn't stand the test of time. You become like Chicken Little, you know, the sky is falling and it never falls. The alternative instead, I think, was to recognise the reality and to find a Marxist explanation for the long boom without conceding that capitalism has overcome its inbuilt tendency to crisis. And the international socialist group around Tony Clift argued that capitalism had been temporarily stabilised and this stabilisation was by the production of arms, which acted as a counter tendency to the falling rate of profit. In other words, their analysis of capitalism said that crisis then was not eliminated from the system, but merely postponed. And as it turned out, the economic challenge for the United States when it came was from its erstwhile allies, Japan and West Germany, losers in World War II, and therefore not putting vast amounts of their investable surplus into arms spending. Actually, they were the real challenge. And so the argument that the International Socialist Group had made about the impact of arms spending on both holding up the rate of profit over a lengthy period, but also providing the basis for undermining it, was borne out in the way in which competitive accumulation going on in Japan and West Germany increasingly challenged the US economically. And then added to this was the US's involvement in the war in Vietnam. This was not a proxy war like Korea, much as the US's domino theory tried to paint it as such. This was a national liberation movement with mass support. And the US, the biggest military force in the world, could not beat the National Liberation Front. They increasingly lost control of their own soldiers, and what will be, I'm sure, a wonderful session tomorrow at 12 at the conference talking about the soldiers' revolt in the US Army in Vietnam. So they lost control of their own soldiers. A mass anti-war movement at home seemed also out of control. And they could not stop the accelerating cost of the war, which under the economic competition pressure from Japan and Germany, West Germany, was really starting to bother them. The war increased US total military outlay by 30%, and even US big business began to protest at the cost to the government. So things were shifting. The stability, the kind of there are two blocks and always shall they be so, was no longer as stable as it had seemed in the 40s and 50s. In the mid-60s, it could still seem as if Cold War stability could go on forever, especially as détente became the order of the day, that is, the policy of relaxing tensions between the Soviet Union and the West that the rulers of both sides agreed to. Yet the period from the mid-60s to the early 1990s was marked by social upheavals, especially the international rebellions of 1968 onwards on both sides of the Iron Curtain, by economic crises, again, in both blocs, by some bitter strikes, and eventually by the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. Because economic slowdown and then economic crisis, the return of recession for the first time since the Great Depression, that return of crisis in the West undermined political stability, even though it also posed severe challenges to the workers' movement as generalised job insecurity became a feature everywhere. Stalinism became increasingly unpopular on the left, even with some communist parties, so that after Russia invaded Czechoslovakia to put down what was known as the Prague Spring in 1968, there were some communist parties that began to say, we can't follow you in this, we're not actually going to back this anymore. There are all sorts of reasons why they did that, which I won't have time to go into. But the other thing to mention at this point is this was followed by repeated upsurges of struggle in Eastern Europe, some of which I mentioned before. So the end of the Cold War. Let's bring these things to a conclusion. Again, I'll go back to Chris Harmon. He has a nice summary. He talks about the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Eastern Bloc in the late 80s. He said, more governments fell from power in 1989 to 90 than at any other time in Europe since 1917 to 18, and before that, 1848. The Eastern Bloc was suddenly no more, and by 1991, the pillar which had supported it, the USSR, had crumbled as well, pulled down by a combination of economic crisis and class struggle. In Eastern Europe, since 1968, there had been deepening crises and repeated upsurges of struggle. Crushing opposition in Czechoslovakia militarily in 1968 and militarily in Poland by the Polish state in 1981 could not remove the underlying crises that had given rise to this opposition. Rates of economic growth were now similar to those in the major Western economies, which meant low. In addition, the 1980s saw the Reagan government in the US embarking on a new arms buildup. As I've said earlier, armaments and military competition were an essential part of post-war capitalism, both West and East. But as crisis began to hit, this had a much greater effect on the weaker economies of the Eastern Bloc. And so Reagan in particular decided that it would be a good idea to tear up the strategic arms limitation treaties and to embark on a rearmament program that was unprecedented since 1951 in both NATO and Warsaw Pact countries. There was the creation of a new generation of weapons of mass destruction alongside this, the revival of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, which had been quiescent really since the early 1960s, was revived. At the same time, the trade, finance and capital links that had been built up for the first time between East and West in the 1970s were rapidly curtailed by the West in the 1980s, and that further increased the relative economic backwardness of the Eastern Bloc. Something had to give. When Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the leader of the USSR from 1985, began to talk in 1987 of glasnost, meaning openness, he raised people's hopes so that they began to challenge the exploitation and oppression that they experienced for 60 years. And there were nationalist revolts, miners' strikes, all kinds of struggles broke out. And for the Eastern European regimes, this was a disaster. Gorbachev's inability to crush dissent at home lost them their ultimate bargaining chip, which was the threat of Russian intervention. In September and October 1989, demonstrations in East Germany forced the government to negotiate with the protesters, and the government began to demolish the Berlin Wall, that image of the Cold War divide, and so on across the Stalinist states until only Russia remained. Sadly, the leadership of these movements in Eastern Europe, unsurprisingly, when you think of the ideological effects of 50 years of the Cold War, there's only two camps you can be in, and the weakness of the revolutionary left as an alternative, the leadership of these movements were either elements of the old bureaucracy determined to ride the wave of opposition in order to contain it and then to be the beneficiaries of it, Vladimir Putin springs to mind here, or oppositions determined that Western capitalism was the model that they were going to bring into being as the alternative to Stalinism. And so the Cold War ended, but imperialism did not. For a decade or two, there was a much more unipolar world with US hegemonic, but the underlying dynamic of imperialism, the competition between the major powers, which always tends in a military direction, that continued. And as economic competition rearranged the imperialist hierarchy, every power knew that their position depended in the end on the armed forces they could deploy. Arms races are not a thing of the past. So to conclude in a few words, the Cold War was a time of imperialist tension, of militarism, and of nationalist paranoia on both sides. It was also a time that led to radical struggle in both the East and the West with the rebellions from 1953 and 1956, and especially in 1968 on both sides of the divide, posed the possibility of an alternative approach that was an alternative to either pro-Western liberalism or Stalinist campism. What was missing was political leadership of sufficient size and influence in the working class to make neither Washington nor Moscow but international socialism a reality. But that slogan kept alive the real Marxist tradition during the Cold War, when Stalinism and Western liberalism could well have extinguished it, and I'll leave it there.